trying to keep the faith, grinding day to day.
Good day, fellow emergent villagers. It's great to be with you again. I'm Melvin Bray, and we are about to embark upon our third session with Jürgen Moltmann from the Emergent Village Theological Conversation of 2009. This session was a deeply moving and deeply challenging portion of the conversation. Moltmann gets into his understanding of the theology of the cross, what it teaches us about the type of God we serve, a God who is not triumphal, a God who is not always strong, a God who is vulnerable, yet because of that vulnerability, is compassionate. The theme of this portion of the conversation was shaped by this answer to the question of theodicy. Why is there suffering? Why is there evil in a world where God is both omnipotent and good? It is a question raised by Jesus on the cross when he yells out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Moltmann responds with this. The why question cannot be answered because we would accept no answer. Or in other words, no answer is sufficient. Moltmann goes on to say the answer God gave to the why question of Jesus was the resurrection, a new reality, but not an explanation. We don't want an answer which would bring us to peace with suffering. Not just that we can't hear the answer, but that perhaps we shouldn't want an answer that leads us to be at peace with suffering. Well, as soon as I heard that, my mind went to the events of this past week. The United States of America was visited by the president of China, Hu Jintao. Of course, it became of paramount importance, perhaps particularly to political leaders of faith, to challenge President Hu Jintao on China's human rights record, to challenge the president with the suffering caused by the lack of attention given to human rights in China. It comes as no surprise that many of President Obama's political opponents did not feel he was demonstrative enough in his critique of China. In the media, some of the critique that was heard would suggest that absent open hostility to China's lack of religious liberty and policy of forced abortion or sterilization to guard against the birth of siblings and torture to extract information and transparency that comes with a robust and unhindered press, absent open hostility, America has not done enough to express its disdain for China's record on human rights. The words of Moltmann emphatically confess that there is indeed something wrong with being at peace with human suffering in any form. When pressed about what it means to not live at peace with suffering, as you will hear, Moltmann ultimately lands on living into the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Pray for those who curse you. Do good for those who despitefully use you. And to me, this seems at odds with this hostility advocated by some people of faith. Of course, China's human rights record is awful. But so is America's. And now that some of you are done gasping, yes, there are human rights atrocities in our history. And it's not just the far distant history or the obscure history, but in recent years, we have struggled with human rights offenses in at least the execution of our war on terror, if not in other ways. And it leaves me to wonder, would our admonishments of China find greater resonance if they weren't so laced with hypocrisy? What if the teachings of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount weren't just ideals for the sweet by and by, but actual confessions of faithfulness that we commit ourselves to? Confessions from which we don't let ourselves off the hook. Confessions to which we repent time and time again when we see that we've gotten off the right track. It's hard to say. Well, the next voice you will hear is Danielle Sawyer, who will serve as the session moderator for this, the next session, with Jürgen Moltmann.
One word, one life, one choice, one night.
I'm Danielle Sawyer. I'm the pastor of Journey Church in Dallas. And I'm thrilled to be here just because, like all of us, we've been very influenced by Moltmann's theology. This session, we're going to be talking primarily about the crucified God, which we have a lot of questions about. But before we do that, we'll just go down the row and have all of the panelists introduce themselves as well.
Hi, I'm Don Heatley. I'm the pastor of Vision Community Church in Warwick, New York. We're an innovative church up there, and we kind of combine a more contemporary, in the good sense of the word, form of worship with contemporary theology. And I've also worked for about 25 years as a video producer as well.
My name is Ann Pittman. I'm a minister at First Baptist Church in Austin, Texas. I'm the minister to young adults, which means that I work with the 18 to 39-year-old demographic, and I'm the minister of creative discipleship, which means that I run a theater and an alternative worship service.
My name is Mike Stavland. I'm part of a church called Common Table out just outside Washington, D.C. I'm a parent of two girls and a son. What else? I recently bought a house. And so I'm happy to be here this week and out of the crawl space of the house. This is a nice change for me.
Well, we all have a lot of questions about crucified God. For a number of us in the room, I'm assuming this was, as Tony said earlier, a life-changing book. I didn't think that much soteriology made sense until I read this book, and this was the thing that finally helped me understand what was going on Good Friday. So I know we have lots to ask, and we'll just start asking questions.
We've been collaborating, the three of us, about the kind of questions we're going to ask, and I think Don and Ann are coming at this more from a maybe generous perspective as pastors of kind of how we can translate this to other people. I'll confess that my reading of your work was more as in a personal, maybe selfish way, as I try to kind of work through my own pain and kind of changing my own ideas about God. Saturday will be 3 years since my son died, who was only 4 months of age. Yeah. So there's... my reading is influenced by the pain that I personally feel and the questions that I have about his pain as just a person who had a very short life, a very difficult life. He had heart surgery at 3 days of life and just a very... so lots of questions about where is God and kind of all that. So your work has been really helpful to sort of reframe that, to remember the pathos of God, the passibility of God. And it struck me as I was reflecting on your work, I sort of did this whole cliche thing. My son died in the middle of the night, and later at the end of that very long day, I found myself outside our house, kind of screaming at the sky, why? Asking God, why? And it struck me in reading your work that I wonder if you would suggest that God was sitting there next to me saying the same thing. That God is both withstanding the question and also asking it. And I wondered your thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the why question cannot be answered because we would accept no answer.
Yes. Thank you.
the answer God gave to the why question of Jesus was a resurrection, a new reality, but not an explanation why you must die and why because of the guilt of your parents or the bad karma of your, all these explanations are wrong and unacceptable,
I
believe.
We ask for what we don't really, what's not going to satisfy us.
We don't want to have an answer which would bring us to peace with the suffering. But if we feel the presence of the suffering Christ next to us or in us, that he shares our suffering and we his, then we have a consolation. We are not alone. Mm-hmm. At least this is my experience. Our first child died at birth.
Yeah. I remember reading that.
Yeah. The other question is whether there is a process after death to fulfill the destiny of a life which was cut short. And I believe there is. Fegefeuer? Not purgatory, but God will bring to a good end what he had begun with a human person.
Yes.
And I trust in that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that your dismissal of this question of theodicy, and yet at the same time, I think this question, the question of how can God let these things happen, is so ubiquitous. It seems like we ask, at the same time, I affirm what you say, that's the wrong question. And two, it reminds me of a couple of years ago, we had a similar conversation like this with Jack Caputo, who wrote this book that was a very big help to me then, as my grief was very fresh, called The Weakness of God, where he borrows terminology from physics and says that there's sort of strong forces and weak forces, that God is a weak force.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as a friend told me as we were talking about it, gravity is one of the weak forces. And we don't understand it exactly, but obviously it keeps us, we're sitting here because of gravity. It's very pervasive, but it's weak. And you suggest that instead of sort of the, how could God let this happen, the better question is, where is God? Is God here?
Yeah. Excuse me.
Oh, of course. So I think that you're right in the sense that the question is sort of contrived, this sort of theodicy. Yet people constantly critique God and our ideas of God. And this, so to what do we attribute this sort of ubiquitous question? Do we blame it on Leibniz? Do we say that it's a kind of a only a philosophical thing? Only a kind of philosophical question?
Well, it comes from a Stoic philosophy. Mm-hmm. If God is omnipotent and good, how can he? Mm-hmm. Either in face of evil and suffering, he is omnipotent, then he is not good, or he is good and not omnipotent. So there is no understanding of the love of God and the suffering of God and the compassion of God, because it starts from two qualifications of God coming from Greek philosophy and not from the God of Israel or the God of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you. The more I thought about it, I not only felt the compassion and sympathy of Jesus in his passion with our suffering, but also the bereavement of the Father. If Jesus really was true, saying, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" then the Father is also forsaken by his Son. Mm-hmm. And we then have two sides of the triune God, one which suffers bereavement, as we do, mm-hmm. and the other who is suffering forsakenness. Mm-hmm. And this is, for me at least, a consolation.
God that is very powerful, and you know, oh, God wanted this and God didn't want that, and they want these concrete answers. And so the idea of a God that is vulnerable on the cross, or vulnerable looking at the cross and feeling that emotion, how do we take that into our churches? How do we communicate the vulnerability of God on the cross?
Well, by preaching the presence of Jesus Christ, instead of talking about a God apart from the life and the destiny of Jesus Christ. When I, in my younger years, I talked about this morning, had problems with God, Jesus came and solved these problems I had with God. So theodicy question is a problem people have with God, but they won't have these problems with Christ. And therefore, without Christ, I would certainly be an atheist as the other members of my family, because looking into human history, I'm not convinced there is a God who has everything under control. Looking into nature with tsunami and earthquakes, etc., the idea that a God exists and this God is love to human beings and the rest of the creation would never occur to me. I'm only convinced of the existence of a God and that this God is love by Jesus. And therefore, I don't like the general talk about a God. There are so many gods, good and evil.
If I could just ask a follow-up to that. I love this morning that you mentioned about our theologians listening to people, mm-hmm. And the questions they have. And along those lines, I find when I speak to people as a pastor of a God is suffering with them, there is, as Anne said, a little bit of a sense of disappointment, because they may feel like they're in a situation where they've fallen into quicksand, and I'm telling them, oh, and the person you were waiting to come in and rescue is also in there with you, and what they really want is someone to pull them out. So how do we connect the suffering God, how does the suffering God give us hope?
Well, first of all, the suffering God is a compassionate God. The God who is there in your distress and your situations, he is not far away from you because he is compassionate and is suffering with you. On the other hand, the outcome of the crucifixion of Christ was the resurrection of Christ. And the new life and the eternal life, and therefore I trust that the God who has compassion with me and who bears me will also bring me into resurrection and life. So the suffering God is only the one side. The other side is the resurrecting God, the joyful God, but who cannot be with you in your suffering, cannot rescue and save you from death, I believe. In my early books, I was always one-sided, only with the wisdom of growing older, you become more than one-sided. But to make a point, you must be one-sided and say, there is this, in an ongoing dialogue with the opinions of other people, of course. In a debate, you are always one-sided. Otherwise, you would kill the debate. So the more I think about it, every theology of the cross must end in a theology of resurrection. I think I learned this from Paul Ricoeur, hinting to two remarks of Paul in the letter of the Romans: how much more is grace than sin? How much more is a resurrection than the crucifixion of Christ? Paulo Malon, how much more is opening the future in a situation where you see no way out? And the joy of God and the joy with God at the end is certainly greater than the long way of suffering and grief before.
I'd like to continue this line of thinking around theodicy and even the validity of the theodicy question, and just give you kind of two little quotes and then ask you to reflect on that. One is that 2 years ago with Miroslav Volf, he at one point said, basically, atheists are closer to God than most theists because they're arguing with God constantly. I don't know that they're, but this is my question, is are they arguing with this metaphysical concept of God, or are they actually arguing with God? And why I thought of this was because somebody in this room said, it seems like Moltmann fell in love with Christ and then kind of backed into theism. Like it was Jesus first and then theism later. And I don't know if that it would accurately depict this conversion.
No. Atheism and theism are outside of the Trinity. And I believe only in the God of Christ, whom he called Abba, dear Father. So looking at Christ, I see his God, and in the community with Christ, his God becomes also my God. But theism is a general understanding of transcendence, and that there is a higher being somewhere, somehow, etc. So theism is no answer to the problem, and atheism is difficult. You see, in the 19th century, we had this type of protest atheism. The best story about it is in Dostoevsky, the brothers Karamazov. Ivan Karamazov is protesting against God because of the suffering of an innocent child. And he said, well, I have nothing against God in heaven, but that this earth is God's kingdom, I reject this as long as there is no justice on earth. So this was a good protest atheism, and we have this type of Job protest atheism after the war in Camus and other writers, so much that the German Catholic poet Heinrich Böll once said, I don't like these atheists. They always talk about God. But there's now coming up another type of atheism, which is just banality. With Dawkins and I think Heinrich Heine said this in the 19th century already. The theodicy question is, if there is a God, why is there evil? The best answer is, there is no God. That's the best excuse for God. And then the whole question of why is there evil collapses. So only the presupposition that there is a God keeps the question of evil alive and let us hunger for righteousness on earth.
I was going to ask about that with the new atheism of Dawkins and Hitchens, etc. It seems to me, in many cases, the God that they are debunking may not necessarily be the God some of us believe in here, or the God you describe in your work. No. Can you talk a little bit about that, how the way you speak of God is different than the God that they are saying doesn't exist?
Well, they say that probably there exists no God. That is to say, they have no use for God in their life, neither negative nor positive use of God. So you can live without music, of course, but you miss a lot in your life. And so you can live without God, but you will miss a lot of the liveliness of life with this. No, Dawkins has another world view, or Weltanschauung, as we say. For him, the genes are already egoistic, and only the stronger gene will survive. And this brought people, famous journalists in this states, David Brooks, for example, to the conviction that there is competition and the survival of the fittest already before they are human beings, already on the level of the genes. And therefore we need a strong state and a black education and all the rest conservative repression of evil. And I think this is wrong. The genes are neither egoistic nor altruistic, but there are certain pieces which switch on a gene or switch out a gene, and the genes are more socially conditioned than only biologically conditioned. So by acceptance we bring life into another person, by rejection we reduce another person, and this is beyond Darwin's understanding and Dawkins' understanding. Well, there are two lands or countries in Europe where atheism is widespread. This is East Germany and Czechia. And this perhaps because of a long tradition of suffering under religious persecution, etc.
As you're speaking about protest atheism, I think often about your concept of protest hope, that for us as people of God in the world, that we live not necessarily as protest atheists, but as protesting hope. You know, we are the people who hold on to the hope in the face of the suffering of reality. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, what is the art of hope? According to the second letter of Peter, chapter 3:13 or something like that, we should wait and hasten to the future of the coming day of the Lord. To wait and to hasten, it looks like contradictory, but is not. To wait doesn't mean to wait on Godot, but to expect somebody who promised his coming, and you know already the name, and you feel the approach. To wait is not to adjust to unjust conditions in the present, because you know that it can be changed and will be changed, and therefore you resist conformity and silence to injustice and violence in your surrounding. So to wait in this sense means to resist. I think it's in Isaiah 26, where the people in the Babylonian exile say, yes, there are other lords who have dominion over us, but we remember only you and thy name. This is to wait, to expect and to resist. And to hasten, it means to run from one place to another in space. But what does hasten mean in time to the coming day of the Lord? It means to anticipate, to transcend the limitations of reality into the realm of possibility, to anticipate the earth on which righteousness will dwell, and every piece of righteousness we can do here and now is an anticipation of that righteousness which will form the new earth or an everlasting earth. So I interpret to wait and to hasten at this point, to resist and to anticipate.
How do we do that as a church collectively? How do we actively resist injustice, I guess, in the world? How do we actively as a church body resist that and be in dialogue and resistance, I guess, with the powers that be?
Well, follow the Sermon on the Mount.
Duh.
You must be more specific. I think one point in this country would be to resist capital punishment, because this is not according to the righteousness of God. But then you will come into a very into a struggle with more conservative people who believe that this is in the name of God. But after the capital punishment Jesus suffered, there can be, from my understanding, no justification for capital punishment, which is a violence in the name of the state and is creating new violence. And so there are concrete points where you can engage there. I must not show more about it. All the churches, in all the churches we pray, but the New Testament call is not only to pray, but pray and watch. So open your eyes if you pray to God and see what is in contradiction to God and what is an analogy to the coming of God. Watch and don't close your eyes and transcend into the other world. praying with open eyes. Okay.
In The Crucified God, you describe, I forget the exact words, but you talk about the crucified one as, this goes back to what you were saying about capital punishment, I think, too, as almost the crucifixion of all religion, that the cross is the one irreligious object in our faith. Could you talk a little bit about that and expound on that?
Yeah, let's go outside of the camp and live under this irreligious cross. We have turned this instrument of painful dying into something in gold or silver, and etc. I think we should be reminded of the cross on Golgotha again and again. And those who followed the crucified one, the early Christians, were called in their surrounding atheists, because they refused to serve the political demons of the Roman Empire. And then they were martyred to experience the same fate as Jesus did. This changed only with Emperor Constantine, since that foundation of the Holy Christian Empire. We have two crosses at the beginning of Christianity. One is a real cross on Golgotha, the other is a dream cross of Emperor Constantine. In hoc signo vinces, in this sign you will win. This was his dream, and then he let his soldiers paint a cross on their shields, and then he won the battle. And since that time, we have these two crosses at the beginning. So the German Iron Cross, the Victoria Cross in England, the French Cross, the St. George Cross, etc., they all go back not to Golgotha, but to Emperor Constantine. This makes a lot of confusion. All the Christian nations have a cross in their flag, only the Americans don't have it. That's good. And with the foundation of the Christian, the Holy Christian Empire, one God, one Christ, one Emperor, one Empire, this was imperialistic because of the oneness of God and the oneness of the Caesar, etc. And then they had the saint of the Holy Christian Empire, which was Saint George, who was a dragon killer to save the church. He was changed from a martyr to a dragon killer. And there was another dragon killer. This was Saint Michael, the archangel killing the dragon in heaven. So this is a whole kind of symbolism of the Holy Christian Empire, which worked until the present day. I think I agree with the Anabaptists that we must go back to the origin to find a new future for Christianity in the world, outside and apart or after this type of Christian imperialism.
In the States, I talked earlier before lunch about the strife over biblical hermeneutic. There is also a pretty robust conversation going on right now here and in Great Britain about the nature of the atonement. And some more conservative Reformed theologians are making a very strong stand about what's called the penal substitutionary theory of the atonement, coming from Anselm. N.T. Wright and others are kind of pushing back and trying to give a more nuanced, fully orbed understanding of the atonement. When I've tried to explain to people, based on the Crucified God and other books of yours, to give it a name, because I don't know that it falls under the Christus Victor theory or the penal substitutionary theory. I've called it the identificationary theory of the atonement, in that in Jesus Christ, God identified with the godless and God-forsaken aspect of humanity and hung on the cross. And the atonement, and this is what I need some help with, this bridge, the other direction, and then the atonement also happens as we identify with Christ on the cross. So it's a double, a bilateral identification. But I don't know if that theologically, how that economic transaction takes place in the atonement and how you would think about it, because it's very appealing, the idea to me. It's very, very appealing that God suffered, that God really was tempted. Mm-hmm. Jesus really was tempted. It's not just a nice story, but he really did walk in our shoes, and mm-hmm. that when we identify with his suffering on the cross, that's atonement. But I think that probably falls short for some people who want to know exactly how it works.
Well, we can call the first as a Christology of solidarity. He suffers with us. And the second, he suffers for us the guilty. Both sides belong together. He suffers for us is a reconciling suffering. But you must see both sides together. He was given up for our sins and raised for our justification. So the whole process is called justification. On the one hand, forgiveness of sin by the crucified one. On the other hand, resurrection into new life. And the Lutheran tradition failed to see the second part of it. They called forgiveness of sin already justification, which is not. Forgiveness of sin is a negative act which clears the negative things out of your life. And the resurrection and justification brings you into a new life, a new righteous life. And both sides must be seen together. But there is another point, which was my point. So many years I tried to convince Catholics and Lutherans about it, but I cannot get through. On the one side, we have the tradition of the justification of the sinner. Forgiveness of sin, new life, reborn to a new life, etc. But what about the victims of sin? Must we not speak about a justification of the victims of violence and injustice, of sin? If you look into the Psalms, God is righteous because he gives right to those who suffer violence and injustice. So the victims are important, and the justification of the victims is perhaps the first act, because in practical terms, the sinners who have become guilty of their victims have always only a short memory. if they have a memory at all. But those who suffered under their violence and injustice have always a long memory. So if you, on the side of the guilty, want to enter into the truth of your life, listen to the victims, because they can tell you who you really are and what situation you are. There is no justification of the sinners without a justification of the victims first. I think we learned this after the war when we listened to the stories of the survivors of concentration camps, because we knew about concentration camps, but not exactly what happened in concentration camps and the death camps during the war. And the more we listened to the stories of the survivors and looked into the eyes of the survivors, the more we became aware of who we, the Germans, really are. And the same took place in the truth commissions in South Africa. The victims must tell the story, and the perpetrators must listen to the victims to see what they have done, because otherwise they will never become aware of. And in the church we have a good sacrament of repentance. First, confess your errors, confess the truth. Second, change your mind. And third, make good what you have done, evil as much as you can. But we have no ritual and no sacrament for the justification of the victims. They must overcome the depression they feel, that they had been weak and insulted and degraded. So they must get out of this. And then they must overcome the feeling, the quite natural feeling for revenge, to overcome evil by the good, as Paul said. Don't let yourself overcome by evil, but overcome evil with the good. And then they must be alleviated, like raise your hearts to God, and must find a new self-confidence, which victims normally don't have. And then they have the divine key in their hand to forgive. But this is only the end if they have gone through this process, because not the perpetrators can forgive their sins by themselves. They must be forgiven by the victims. And I think this is a lesson Martin Luther King wrote in his famous letter from the jail of Birmingham. Have mercy with these poor white guys who are so racistic, etc. Feel mercy with them. And this brings you in a new sovereign position. But this is also a long process, and parallel to the sacrament of repentance for the sinners or the perpetrators, we need this sacrament for the victims to overcome their depressions.
I wonder, this seems like a good place to ask you to talk a little bit, have a word about love. I think what's so helpful about your work is it reframes so much for us. It kind of gives us a different way of looking at so many mm-hmm. things. And just reflecting on what you've been saying here in the last few minutes about power struggles, it seems to me, where we are, you mentioned the two crosses, and even in sort of the questions that we tend to ask that aren't really helpful, it's sort of a struggle to understand something, and we sort of get into doctrinal debates and things like that. And this book in particular, I think has been critiqued because people have said, when you sort of take away the impassibility of God and the omnipotence of God, you're sort of taking away a lot of what we look for in God. And yet I think you suggest that we experience much more of God's love, and that in fact that we ourselves find love. When we sort of accept the suffering that comes to us, we can find a new kind of love as well. So my book opens to this page now, Stained with Tears. I won't try to read this passage but I'll, to you, but if you could read it and then maybe talk a little bit about love. Is that this right here? Would you like me to read it? I'll do my best.
Okay.
Okay. Therefore, anyone who enters into love and through love experiences inextricable suffering and the fatality of death enters into the history of the human God. For his forsakenness is lifted away from him in the forsakenness of Christ. And in this way, he can continue to love, need not look away from the negative and from death, but can sustain death. Mm-hmm.
What do you want me to do?
Interpret this? I'm sorry. I think you're suggesting a whole different experience of love that we get from God and that we find in God when we allow ourselves to feel pain, to experience our pain and to suffer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the greatest danger for me personally and what I see in other people is when suffering comes to become apathetic. Don't care anymore. Don't love somebody because this will cause only pain. If this beloved person disappoints you or dies. So if you love nobody, you will feel no suffering in relationship to other people. If you don't love yourself, you will not feel your own death because you don't care. I have seen people, soldiers in World War II, who became to such an extent apathetic that they don't care about death, about their own death and the death of others, because they were completely resignated and were no longer in service of life, but in service of death. We have a similar development in the terrorists today. Mullah Omar from the Taliban once told a Western journalist, "Your young people love life. Our young people love death." If you love death, you cannot be threatened with capital punishment. If you are a suicide candidate, you cannot feel any deterrent. And this is the real danger of that people become that way. And therefore, if you go into the love of life again, you risk disappointment. You must be ready to suffer on behalf of your compassion with another person or other people, and you must be ready to feel their dying. And with their dying, a part of your own life given into the love will die also. And you must then trust that there is a new beginning with the resurrection of Christ and etc. So this was my interpretation of it.
One of the things I find most helpful is that I fear that in the West, when we talk about the cross, we have personalized it so far down that it only becomes about us. That when we look at the cross, the way that it's been preached to many of us is that Jesus was hanging up there just really for me, just for me to get somewhere. But in the crucified God, you talk about how in the cross, all of creation finds its place for redemption, which is a very different way of saying that it's not simply about one soul being you know, placed in a position of justification, but that in the cross of Jesus, where the godless and the God-forsaken come together, that all of creation has the space for redemption. I wonder if you would just talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think in the Western tradition, especially the Protestant traditions, we lost the cosmic dimensions of Christology, which we find in the letter of Ephesians and Colossians, that Christ died for the redemption of the universe, because the universe is also corrupted, and there are conflicting powers in the world, even the universe, the cosmos, needs reconciliation and redemption. And this is what universal salvation is all about. Not that all human beings will be saved, but that the universe will be saved. And this is old Orthodox tradition. At the end, is a deification of the cosmos. Christ became human so that humans and the whole earth and the whole cosmos will become the place where God dwells, and by this will be deified. This is a theosis tradition in the Orthodox Church. And I think this is important to see at the end a all-embracing power, and not only salvation of my soul and my body can go in the abyss, not only my personal salvation and the rest of the world may go into hell, not only human beings will be saved and all the plants and the other creatures will be burned in fire or whatsoever, but the end will be the restoration of all things in Christ. This is a phrase in Colossians 1:20, as far as I remember. And this is according to a pietistic German tradition, die Wiederbringung aller Dinge, the restoration, the bringing back of all things which have passed away in the end, so that there is not only hope for the coming generations, but also hope for the generations which passed away. And this is what resurrection is all about. Again, in the modern experience of an ecological crisis and maybe an ecological catastrophe which is approaching, we need this cosmic dimension in order to do what is necessary to do today vis-a-vis of the dangers which may come. And so this is not speculation, but this is very realistic.
So when I was trying to explain to my friends and family who you were, about where I was going, I said, well, I love Moltmann because he's a Christian universalist. So my question for you, I guess, is it fair for me to call you that based on what you just said, or is there another description you would like to use?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not a universalist because, you know, there are perhaps a few people I don't want to see again. But God may be a universalist because he had created them and would certainly like to see them again. So this would be my answer to this question. But universalism is not only to speak about all human beings. It's about to speak about the universe, the stars and the moon and the sun and the whole cosmos. And this is always misunderstood by these fundamentalists who want to have a dual end, the one go to heaven, the other go to hell, and the earth will be burned in fire. This is anti-creation. I don't want to go to heaven. The angels have their home in heaven. I want to be raised on earth and to live in the new earth on which justice dwells. Point. And if God at the end will be all in all, where's the hell? I think Christ's descent to hell has a eye-opening effect for us, to those we wish to go to hell. Martin Luther once said in a treatise on preparing for dying with hell, don't look at hell in the destiny of others. Don't look at hell in your own destiny. Look at hell in the wounds of Christ. There the hell is overcome. Because Christ suffered hell before his dying, not only afterwards, in this God-forsakenness thing. So in the wounds of Christ, you must look if you want to talk about hell. Not threatening others with hell, but tell them about the wounds of Christ. This so far to universal salvation.
I'm stretching out. I'll give it till I've given out. The Emergent Village podcast is brought to you by Emergent Village. For now, if you'd like to become a sponsor of the podcast, feel free to contact me at melvinbray@gmail.com. If you have content that you'd like to hear on the podcast at some point, please feel free to send it my way. Our theme is gifted to us by Eugene the Fourth, a friend of mine here in Atlanta, Georgia, a local artist and producer. You can learn more about Emergent Village at www.emergentvillage.org. And while you're at it, come explore a new project that we're engaged in with ECW Media Society. It's called faithcollaboratory.org. That's FAITHCOLLABORATORY.org. Check it out. Until next time, have fun on the Village Green. Take care.